to another episode of Ruby for All. Julie, what is up?
The sun is out. Woo! And I feel like spring is coming. How about
spring
you?
Spring is coming. I have been very happy with the weather lately. Is it sunny today? I don't feel like it got a little cloudy. There's some storms happening in the area. I know Colorado got clapped with snow yesterday.
Oh, no.
So I think we might be getting a little residual cloudiness today, but it has been sunny. It's been nice and warm. I've been like outside walking. I've been loving it.
Yeah, I am waiting for it to warm up a little before I go walking. Although I'm very much like you, where I need to be pretty warm out there to feel like I want to walk out there.
Yes, the cold natured club. Welcome. It's a curse. Anyway, I had a problem today. I'm going to tell you about it.
Just one.
No, I've had multiple, but this is the relevant one. Yesterday, I got a bug report about a new feature. So me and my project partner, Diogo, just launched a new feature at Podia. And there was an issue that someone in support raised yesterday, and I fixed it, I thought. And I deployed it, and then the person responded to me this morning at 3 a.m. because they are on, some of our support people are not in this time zone. And he was like, you fixed it-ish. He made a screen recording of what was happening with no audio. And I had to debug what was going on. Julie, you want to talk about debugging today? Because that's where my mind is at today.
And that was really relatable to me because I'm also trying to debug something that I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to.
Those are sometimes the best and the worst. Let's start off broad level. Let's just talk about debugging in Ruby. The state of debugging in Ruby. That's going to be the title of this episode. The state of debugging in Ruby. So there's different types of bugs. There's like actual exceptions. Those are easier, I find, to catch. Then there's runtime errors. And then there's JavaScript errors. And then there could just be like behavioral errors. So today, my issue was a behavioral error because the backend was getting the correct data. There were no exceptions being raised in Honey Badger, and there were no logs proving that anything was going wrong. So I'm in like a weird state of trying to figure out what's going on. And my question to you is, when you are in that weird state of not having any idea of what's going on, how do you kind of settle down and get started?
It's funny also because Megan, who was previously on the show, my mentee, was taking a look at a bug and she asked me the same exact question, like, where would you start with this if this was assigned to you? And I told her that the first thing that I would do is first making sure I understand the product. So the reason why I say this is because I just joined this new team, and so I may not understand everything about it or about what they work on. And so the first thing I would do is try to replicate it and try to understand, like, what is the expected behavior? And in your ticket, it should list those things, right? Like, it should list, if possible, reproduction steps and what is the expected behavior.
So those are like the first two items on my like punch list of bugs. So understanding the problem, which sounds like the easiest, quickest first start. It's usually just written in the ticket. Now I understand the problem, but it's so much deeper than that. And I feel like a lot of times returning back to step one of understanding the actual problem is how I get myself unstuck. A lot of times I need to go back, relook at the ticket, like with almost like with fresh eyes, but just like, what is the problem? What is happening? Where is this at? Just kind of build up that mental context over and over again. So when I get stuck, I tend to do that. The second thing I do once I feel like I understand the problem, and so like on this ticket, I watched this video. It didn't have any audio. That threw me off because I was like, are my headphones not working? And I realized they were working. There was just no audio. So I had this extra step of trying to understand this problem. Like, okay, well, they kind of said what it was, but I didn't understand in the ticket what it was. And I had to watch the video like two or three times to like actually understand, okay, I see what's happening now. And then my immediate next step is almost always, can I reproduce this bug locally? And if the answer is no, I try to reproduce it in production. And if the answer is no, then we move on to the next steps. But hopefully you can reproduce the bug in development. Today, I could not reproduce the bug in development at first.
Okay. this whole time, I'm like very curious, what is this bug? And I'm wondering if you're at some point going to tell us.
I will. I'm weaving it in.
And the funny thing is that the bug that I was telling you that I'm working on, I also cannot replicate it in development, but I still haven't. So I'm curious to hear your story.
Can you replicate it in production?
Yes.
Okay. So if you can replicate it in production, this is usually where I start there. Logging is probably your best friend. If you're using some sort of log aggregator, there's tons out there. I'm not going to list any. Or whether you just literally SSH into the box and tail the log. Or you can, Heroku has log built in to their platform. So however you view logs in your application, because everyone seems to have their own thing every time, every place, something new, some different thing to do. However you view your logs, go there first and start trying to figure out, okay, when I make this request, this is what happens next. And then these parameters come across to this controller. Are these parameters correct, right? Kind of like algorithmically reproduce the problem and use the logs to verify whether or not they look correct to you or not, or whether that might then surface errors, stack trace errors, random issues, like maybe Redis isn't connected. I've had that happen before where Redis accidentally got disconnected and my feature wasn't working because it couldn't connect to Redis. And that wasn't an exception. It was just once I looked in the logs, then I could see it. But like understanding a stack trace is like a vital part of debugging. And I also feel like it's the hardest part. So you're a couple of years into your career now. When you get that red Rails error page, what do you do first?
Oh gosh, I don't see the red Rails page, or at least not at work.
Do you have like better errors installed or whatever that gem is?
No, or what's that?
There are gems that will enhance the error page basically in Rails.
Oh, no, I just think I am not working out of Rails like that. But the first thing that I do when I see an error, well, I guess this is kind of a hard question because I'm not usually the one finding the error. It's usually like in the ticket.
Well, so this would work for JavaScript too. If you get except freaking JavaScript errors. I've been writing React all week. I'm so very frustrated. I don't want to talk about it. You can apply very similar principles like in JavaScript too. Okay, I have an error. What are like some of the ways I can resolve this? The answer is not immediate. A lot of times, I just want to say, if you really, read the error message, sometimes it will tell you exactly what you need. And I see a lot of, especially newer people, get those error traces and then they kind of like glaze over it and then go back to their code and try to figure out where in the code is broken. But like that error page is there for a reason, right? And you start with that error. Once you fully understand that error, just like in production, like when we're trying to recreate these errors, you have to fully understand that problem. So jumping back to the code, unless you were like, oh, I forgot a semicolon, I know that. Unless a lot of times reading the error page or reading it in the logs is very important. And I think something you can build up as a skill of being able to spot, like, I know what the important parts of this log message are, or I know where to look in the stack trace for where this occurred. There's like tools you can build up internally like that, but just reading it well and understanding exactly what it's telling you a lot of times can take you pretty far.
Why do you think in general, maybe newer folks or maybe even seasoned folks will look at the error and maybe glaze over it? Or do you think they're making assumptions as in, oh yeah, I think I know where this is, so I'm going to go there, but then kind of miss the fine detail?
I think that's definitely a piece of it. And I have stuff to say about assumptions, but I think that's a big piece of it. I think for newer people, it's almost like, I don't know the best way to word this, not like a panic, but it's like you see it and it's like, oh crap, stop. It's all red and it's like, stop, everything stop. And all of a sudden things aren't going the way you want them to.
Hi there, Julie here. I would like to take a moment to thank GoRails for sponsoring this episode. When I was first starting out, I struggled with finding up-to-date content to help me level up. Then I learned about GoRails. Not only does GoRails provide new screencasts weekly, they also have two fantastic instructors that break down complex topics into digestible chunks. On top of that, I really appreciate when they explain the whys behind the subject. One of my favorite walkthroughs is creating your first Ruby gem from scratch. What a great way to learn by stripping down to just the basics. If you care about leveling up as a Ruby engineer, you can't go wrong with GoRails. Check it out at gorails.com.
I want to say that the first thing that I would do is like copy the error message and then put it in Google. But I feel like I haven't done that as much lately.
Well, that's just because you're becoming a 10X engineer, Julie.
No.
You're climbing up the rungs. I mean, you could totally do that. I do that all the time. I did that yesterday.
Where sometimes you just have to, like maybe you've never seen something before or, oh, now, and I know we'll talk about Copilot soon in a future episode, but sometimes I'll actually ask Copilot to explain stuff and error that's inside of my terminal or something like that. And that's been helpful because I can kind of use Copilot to rubber duck.
Yes. You can tell Copilot to explain your last terminal command to debug error messages. Sometimes I'll paste the error message just straight into VS Code and ask Copilot to explain it, to break it down. Yeah, there's lots of ways you can use tools like that to kind of better understand the error. And Google, the very first AI, I guess, like who among us has not copied an error and pasted into Google? I'm curious though for you, I find myself doing that a lot more when it's related to dependencies.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
Everyone does that. I feel like that's usually step one, right? If you don't
Part
immediately, if you read it and you're like, I don't know why this is happening, I feel like that's usually step one. For a lot of people, it's just send it to Google, which is fair enough. But then let's say Google doesn't help you, right? So there are lots of debugging tools you can use. If you use RubyMine, RubyMine is a fully featured IDE integrated development environment that has like full debugging capabilities like that you would get from Java, things like that. That functionality has made its way to VS Code. And I mean, I remember years ago trying to make it work in VS Code and like you could hackily get it working, but it wasn't like as great as like debugging JavaScript, for instance, which never will be, but it wasn't comparable. It was so much faster to use Pry, to use Bybug, to use Binding IRB than to use the debugger. That is starting to change. The Ruby LSP has taken that a far way and there are other people in the community leveraging the LSP to add like advanced debugging capabilities to RSpec tests and to make the VS Code debugger more useful. But I think almost everyone, Bybug, Pry, the debug gem, binding.irb, whichever one you use, because most people have one that they prefer, you probably use one of them. But the other massive way I see people doing it is what they refer to as puts debugging, which is just what it sounds like. You put a bunch of put statements in your code. I like to do, in a Rails app specifically, I like to do Rails logger messages instead. So you can do like rails.logger.warn and pass messages like that.
Why do you prefer that over puts?
Because I want to see it in the context that it's happening. So if I'm using log statements, that's typically because there's a chain of execution occurring and something going wrong in that execution. So step one, step two, step three, step four, step five is all encapsulated inside of one object maybe. And something is going wrong somewhere in there. Or maybe it's in a background job. When you use the Rails logger, you get to see it in the context of the request that's happening. And depending on like the level of logging you have in your Rails app turned on, you can see like all the SQL statements that are happening before and after it. And that can help you get more context of what the state of things that are happening around it versus just using puts. So I use Overmind, so I'm not sure. When you use puts debugging, you don't see it in the Rails log, which is what I tail basically all day long. Like I'm tailing like a Rails log in Tmux, and that's how I view like what's going on. So that's why I do it. I want to know what's happening in the app. I want to read the server basically logs, and I want to see the errors happening in the context that they happen, or the log statements get hit in the context and order too.
So is puts debugging similar to JavaScript's console log debugging?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And whether you use puts or like the Rails logger, it doesn't really matter. It's kind of just personal preference. But the one benefit you get with using the Rails logger is, so we're debugging in development right now. Let's say we still can't figure out what's happening. we can barely reproduce it. Let's say we can only reproduce it in production sometimes. That's a lot of times where I will go add extra logging messages to the app. I don't keep log messages in the app unless it is something important that I want to be able to grep for when I am reading my production logs. So like in Honey Badger, you can do honeybadger.notify to like pass information to it. And you can use tags and things like that, depending on whatever error monitoring service you're using or logging service. They all have these types of things where you can specifically create issue or an error or a specifically formatted logging message. And that can provide you more context of like, let's say it only happens for EU users. The context that you add to those types of statements that you would maybe put into production can help you find errors like that.
Nice.
I'm personally a Pry user, but we recently at work, Jamie deleted the Pry gem to my great dismay. And we now use the official debug gem. And I probably could just update my freaking editor aliases, but I really just want to alias binding.pry to this new gem, the new format, because I've been writing binding.pry in my Rails code my entire Rails career. It is so hard for me not to write binding.pry. It would be like changing console.log basically for in JavaScript to like something else. That's how it is for me.
Is the debug gem that different from pry? And also we have binding.irb that's built in, right?
Binding IRB now uses the debug gem.
Oh, okay.
So IRB now uses the debug gem by default. I think that happened in Ruby 3.3 something, maybe 3 flat. So if you're using binding IRB in Ruby 3 and up, you're probably using the new debug gem. And you can tell because the easiest way to tell for me is it has autocomplete, unless you turn it off, okay. Which you can turn it off. But okay. The debug gem offers autocomplete features. So you can type your model name dot. Yeah. That's the fastest way I can tell you how to know if you're using it.
Yeah. Okay.
The things that I do every day, I can still do in the debug gem, no problem. There is one exception, and that is with Pry. I'm going to try to explain this, but it's kind of technical. Let's say I open up a Rails console and I say user equals user dot first. So I save user into a variable. In Pry, you can cd, just like changing directories in the file system, you can cd into an object in Pry and then be in the context of that object. So where I used to use this a lot is at another place I used to work, we had all these jobs that would then kick off all these interactors. So if I had a bug in a job, I would instantiate the job, save it to a variable, and then I would cd into the job object, which puts me in the context, like almost if I'm in that file, and then I have all the private methods available that I could access. So like I said, it's hard to explain, but it's easy to watch. It just allows you to change context into different objects. So if you're in your job, but like your interactor has these private methods and that's where the error is occurring, you can cd into that object and then be in that context and have access to those methods.
And that sounds like it would be really useful. Do you have a workaround?
No, I do not have a workaround. Hmm. I don't use it all the time. There was a point the other day where I was like, oh, well, I've instantiated this interactor, but the error is actually occurring in an interactor that this one calls. And my first instinct was like, oh, I'll just CD into this object and then I can go down from there. And I couldn't do that. And I was like, I was frustrated. Hmm. That's the only difference. Like the debug gem also has a lot of really good features. I'm sure there's other things you can do in Pry that I'm not mentioning, but like for the things that I mainly do, that's the only thing that I lost. I'm going to start spitting a few more steps I take to try to like effectively debug what's going on. We already talked about understanding the problem, reproducing it, trying to simplify the problem. I would kind of throw that into step one, but a lot of times if you can't reproduce the bug, then kind of going back to the problem is a good next step of, okay, what else can I understand about the context of this?
Sometimes when we're like really into it and we're like super stuck and we say like, oh, some of the best things we could do is just walk away and then come back. Like sometimes that walking away and come back is similar to the, okay, go back to the first step.
Yes. That's on my list actually. Perfect. We talked about logging, debugging tools, going back and looking at changes in the code base that have happened recently. That's something I did literally yesterday trying to find a bug. I was like, I thought this was working. Something seems to have changed using Git for that. Git bisect, I'm not going to explain it here, but that is an extremely powerful tool that not a lot of people use, but is the perfect tool to isolate what commit broke a certain thing in your application. Git bisect. We'll put a link to, in the show notes of the docs. Question your assumptions. This is something that I struggle with a lot. A lot of times I get a bug report and I make immediate assumptions about what's going on. And sometimes those assumptions lead to me going down rabbit holes that are unproductive. And I end up not actually figuring out my issue because of that original assumption. I'm like looking in the wrong place maybe for it, or I'm thinking about it in the wrong way. Read the documentation. If a Rails thing is not working the way it's supposed to, or a dependency is not doing what it's supposed to do, read the documentation and then you can read the code. Go look in there and see what's actually supposed to happen. Take a break. You mentioned that. Perfect. I think the biggest one for me is get a second opinion. Get another set of eyes. Get a pair programmer. But what I told a developer the other day, and I truly believe in, I solve a lot of my problems by typing out my question to another developer. Like I'll start drafting a message like to Julie, but okay, Julie, I have this bug. Here's an explanation of like what the bug is. Here's what I've tried to do to fix it. Here's what I think is going on. Here's what's not working, et cetera. So in the process of laying out a helpful message for a coworker to read and possibly help you with, I solve the problem a lot of times just doing that. But if that alone does not help you, then get that second pair of eyes, take a break, sleep on it. Those are all big ones.
Yeah, the last thing you said is very similar to rubber ducking, right? Like you can just verbally say out loud to your rubber duck on your desk.
Yeah,
exactly that. And
I'll start a new Zoom call and maybe I'll record it. Maybe I won't, but I'll just start a Zoom call and then explain the issue like I would explain it, talk it out loud. Super helpful. And that's kind of like going back to reframing, reanalyzing the problem.
Yeah. Oftentimes I'll like draft out something and I will come up with new ideas on what I can try before sending the message.
Yeah. You have to test hypotheses and be able to like say what happened when you tried them.
If you're like most devs, too much of your time gets sucked up with downtime issues, troubleshooting, and error tracking. How can you spend more time shipping code and less time putting out fires? Honeybadger is how. It's a suite of monitoring tools specifically for devs. It's the only system that combines error monitoring, uptime monitoring, and cron and heartbeat monitoring into a clean, fast interface. You won't know if Honeybadger will really save you time and trouble until you see how it works in your toolchain. With two lines of code and 5 minutes, you can see for yourself. Honeybadger automatically hooks into popular web frameworks, job systems, authentication libraries, and front-end JavaScript. Imagine fixing errors before your users can even report them. 5 minutes of your time with the free trial is all it takes to see if it will work for you. It just might be the best 5 minutes you've spent in a while. Check out honeybadger.io.
One of the most important parts of good debugging is like your mindset, patience, persistence, and be willing to walk away and come back. But what happens if you can't fix it? What about the unfixable bugs?
Well, the bug that I was working on today, all week, I was just like, wow, this is a really specific issue. And there's only a couple of examples where this is happening in. So I went straight to the reporter of the bug and I asked like, how many learners are reporting of this? And it was a very small number. And so at this point I was like, I spoke with my manager and I said, is it worth putting in all this effort in trying to figure out the reason for this? It's only happening in these three cases and there's been 5 people that have reported it in the past year. So we're thinking maybe it's not worth the effort and maybe it's okay. Maybe there's workarounds that we can do for those 5 folks.
Yes, I'm glad you said that. I mean, we could do a whole separate episode about communicating with support and product and customers about these things, but I agree very much with what you said. The other thing is what I like to do a lot is like be very aware of when you're asked to fix a bug versus change the way something is happening based on their assumptions. So we thought it would work like this. We think it should work like this. That's not broken. That's for the product people or whoever's in charge, however your system works, that needs to go through them before it comes down to you, in my opinion. I'm a very big stickler on that just because of past experiences. Like if you send me a feature request in a bug report, I'm not doing it. And I'm going to kick it back to you pretty much immediately with, you need to talk to so-and-so about adding this feature. Because adding a feature, like it may seem like, oh, well, this is just a tiny little change in the code. There's implications, there's documentation, there's the ways people, how things work. There's design, there's all these steps. Don't just ignore it because it's easy. So I just wanted to add that in addition to what you were saying about maybe we don't fix it because it's not that important or it's not affecting that many people. And that's just a business decision that we're willing to make. Or maybe we're not going to fix it because there's nothing to fix. This is actually a feature request. So I'll finish my story that I've been telling. I couldn't replicate the problem in development. I could replicate the problem in production. So the next thing I did was I opened up a production Rails console and I opened up the logs. So first, I replicated the issue in production again with the logs open and saw what was happening and checked the request. On this specific issue was on a form. So I specifically was like, I want to know the parameters that are coming across when this action occurs. And when I refresh the page, does anything else happen there? So that did not help me. That did not give me the information I needed. What it did help me with is it told me that the parameter that was coming across was correct. It was the value I expected. So I knew that the issue was not with the controller level at that point, right? Because I know, or at least with that part of it, you could be saving it wrong, et cetera, afterwards. But I knew that it was coming across the controller correctly. The next step I did was I opened up the Rails console and I opened the specific record that this form was modifying and I replicated the feature again in production. So I made this change to the form. This was on a checkbox on a form. So I toggled it and the problem was is that it was like resetting. So like if I toggled the checkbox, clicked off to another part of the page and then clicked back to that checkbox, which was in a sidebar, a hidden sidebar that you had to toggle to open, it was resetting the value to what it was when you like opened the page. So it didn't look like it was persisting. It was persisting. I confirmed that when I saw the variable coming across from the controller. And then I opened the Rails console, made the change in production, checked the record. Okay, it changed to what I thought it would. Triggered it, changed the value back on production, reloaded the record in the Rails console. Okay, it updated again correctly. So then I was confused. And I literally laid on the bed beside me. I was like, nothing's ever easy. Ugh. And I stood up, drank some water, ate a Clif Bar, came back, looked at it again. And I was able to realize that since the value was persisting correctly, it was a display issue, right? So the problem was, is that it's not displaying correctly on the front end. So I was like, okay. So then I drilled down into that was, it was in a view component. So I drilled down into that component, read that file very carefully to understand what was going on and noticed a specific method that I was like, okay, I have a feeling that this method is the problem, but I can't confirm that yet. Called my project partner. Hey, I can't reproduce this bug locally. By telling him that, he then had this idea of, oh, well, maybe it's because of this setting that you have higher up. Is that the same setting you have in production? It was not. I had one value on a global option somewhere else different in a different area. I had one value set in production, one in development. That one value is what caused the different behavior. So by changing that, now I could reproduce it in development. And that way I was able to confirm that line that I had an assumption was the problem was the problem. And the problem specifically was that we were doing a logical comparison. So use this value or use this value. And what the goal of the method was basically like, if this value has a value, we want to use it. If this value does not exist, we want to default to this global value. The problem was that we were using the logical OR operator and the value that we were comparing was a Boolean. So the first value that we were comparing would either be true or false, which isn't what we actually wanted to know. We wanted to know if it exists or not, but we were checking basically, is it true or false or the other value? So if the value was false, which was like what we wanted, it was going to use the other value on the opposite side of the OR brackets. The problem is that we didn't want to evaluate that. We wanted to know whether or not the value existed and use it. And if it didn't exist, use the other one. Not, and that doesn't work with just using or when you have Boolean values on each end.
What was your fix-ish the first time?
So it was the exact same error in a different part of the code. We were doing the same type of logical precedence, and it was the same error that we actually wanted to know if it existed and then use the value of that existence, not the way we were doing with just doing like this or this. We wanted to, if this exists, use this, otherwise use that. That code was in JavaScript. So exact same error, completely different parts of the code, and it took me way less time to solve the JavaScript error than it did to solve this one, because that one was a lot easier to replicate in development. Like, it didn't depend on that global value that I'd set. So I could recreate that one immediately, and I could almost immediately spot the issue. Now that I'm saying this out loud, it does beg the question, why didn't I immediately assume that was the problem? So there's an assumption I should have made and didn't. To answer your question, the other error was the exact same error in a different part of the code in JavaScript.
That's funny. And what's also funny is, since we both were working on bugs and I also could not replicate it in development, there is some sort of filtering or some sort that's happening in production and staging that is not currently happening in development. I haven't figured that out yet, but I'm pretty sure that's our problem too.
One thing I like to do is take a record. If you're on like an edit page of a record and the page doesn't render because of an error, take one that you know does work. So like on a, maybe create a new one, a new object for this, and then that has a form. It's like a new post. And then you go into the edit form and then you take those post, that post object, and you copy the values over to the one that has the problem. And that can tell you quickly, is it a problem with the data or is it a problem somewhere else? That can be a quick way to figure out, is this a data problem? Because I had a bunch of those today too, where we had changed like a value in my local setup. I just hadn't updated it. So I was like, this value is different and I don't know why.
Well, I'm glad that you figured it out.
Yes. So you haven't solved your bug yet, right?
No. And we'll likely not solve it.
That is
only the best answer. Only because it's in a repository that's pretty complex and we're not sure that it's worth the effort to solve.
I've been there. That kind of brings up the point of, if it's getting to that level, talk to your manager or talk to the product people. A lot of times my designer, like, I'll come to my project meeting, dude, this thing you made me build took me like 2 days or whatever, is insanely hard. And he was like, why didn't you just tell me? We could have maybe figured something else out. So don't forget to apply that to here too. Just because there's a bug doesn't necessarily mean all the onus is on you. You have a team, use the team.
Yeah, no, totally. I had a one-on-one with my manager today where I raised it and I was like, I'm not sure this is worth it. What do you think?
Nice.
And our PM is currently out, so we'll be asking him when he gets back.
So did you bring evidence to that meeting or was it just like an open discussion?
Evidence.
Was that your desired outcome for the meeting or was it just discussed?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's worth it. It was on my agenda. I didn't put it on the actual agenda, but it was something that I wanted to raise.
A lot of times if you have problems convincing people, sometimes all people need is a little bit of data to back it up. So sometimes when I'm trying to convince people of certain things, I was trying to convince our CEO of something yesterday and I went and I was like, I'll find data to prove him wrong. He was right. But nonetheless, I went in search of that data to be like, okay, well, only these amounts of users are affected under this region, under these circumstances, and then blah, blah, blah. So bringing some of those statistics might help shine a light to your manager, like, oh, this only affects 4 people. Nice. So you
I did the same. I was looking into it without realizing how little it was. And that was when I found out this morning. I was like, I went to the reporter of the bug and asked, like, how often is this actually being reported? So once I got that, I was like, oh yeah, I don't know that this is worth it right now.
Nice. My last favorite one to do is, I'm closing this bug. If it happens again, we'll look into it. This is happening in isolation. Can't figure it out. If it happens again, but I'm like, maybe I'm not convinced it's still happening, but that's also an option too. I need this to happen one more time. Cool. All right. That's all I got. I actually have to go debug something right now. So we'll end it here. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. Same time, same great place, same great people. Bye.
Bye, everyone.